Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Brittany Smith. Scott Brown told the last story from the Trapdoor September Showcase. He's a veteran storyteller and was introduced by Ben Larson. Thank you for listening.
All right, that story was funny-ish. This next story is not funny-ish. John used to be the buckle-up guy, but since he's on hiatus, owning a restaurant-ish and isn't here, it's my turn to tell you, buckle up. Our final storyteller became an instant favorite of ours when he first graced our stage. January. And you've heard me mention his name before. He is the gentleman who will be putting on the Storytelling Club meeting here at Welch's Ale House at 6:30 on Mondays, beginning this Monday. In all seriousness, this is one of those stories that was kind of difficult to workshop with Scott because, well, it'll become pretty evident pretty soon. But it's one of those ones that you could tell was a very difficult story for him to tell. And then giving feedback on that just kind of felt like we were being dicks. Luckily, though, he needs little to no feedback because he's an amazing storyteller. And we just think it's the bravest thing for him to be willing to come up and tell the story that he is about to tell you. And with that said, I'm going to bring to the stage our final storyteller of the night, Mr. Scott Brown.
Everyone having fun tonight?
Yes.
Hold my beer. All right. I think the worst ways you can ever receive bad news are, one, on your Facebook wall. Oh, I guess Scott still has that itch he had a problem with. At least there's topical creams to help, according to his mom. You know you've had those mom posts before, right? Second, skywriting. The house is on fire. Probably too late. And third, text message. Because it's not like they didn't have your phone number in the first place. So it's May 10th, 2016. And my wife and I are getting close to the end of the year that we had been exiled from Orlando, Florida, our favorite place to live up to that point, and we're now in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Now, we've been chasing our careers around the country, and we had gotten into a point that we were chasing my wife's career. She got promoted, went to Fort Lauderdale, which meant that we had to leave all of our friends behind, our family behind, that was in Orlando. That's what the second time we had left Orlando. The first time was for my career, for my job. I'd worked for Bloomingdale's, I got promoted, went to South Florida, ended up going to Los Angeles. My wife hated Los Angeles. We went back to Orlando. She got promoted. We went to South Florida. But something interesting happened there. In the 10 years that we had spent back in Orlando, it became home to us. It became our favorite place to live. And the people that work there became, instead of just friends, they became family. And you know what family are? It's those friends that you want to be family because you don't like your family as much as you like your friends. And there's a lot of nodding going on. You know those people. They were my family. And one reason they were my family is because there was a point in life when I had had a really nice career opening IKEA stores around the country. I was a director of HR. I traveled all around the country opening IKEA stores, and then all of a sudden the economy collapsed. And there were no more IKEA stores to open. I found myself with a lot of spare time, something my friends noticed. I had played college baseball, something else my friends noticed. Their kids thought that I was amusing. They called me Uncle Buck. There's a reason for that. They said one day, and I remember this very well, very vividly, it was at the end of a slow pitch softball season. We played on a team called the Weekend Warriors, and I'm standing beside my Jeep, and my friend's wife walks past me, and she turns to me and looks and says, "Oh, sweetie, thank you so much for agreeing to coach the boys' baseball team this summer. They're tickled pink." I'm like, what, so what? apparently, I had been voluntold to coach baseball. And they all said, well, you have the time. So I did what anybody would do when their friends calling them to help, I helped. That Tuesday, I showed up at the baseball field for my first practice, and it didn't go well. We were the worst team in the league, but we were a team. The reason we were a team is because the community in which everybody lived, except us, our friends lived there, we did not, except us, that community was becoming about 80% Hispanic. Now, if you know anything about baseball and the Hispanic culture, they're somewhat synonymous. Those kids that had never started playing baseball till they were 9 were 6 years behind. They couldn't get on a team, so they had me to coach. They were 8 years old at the time that I started coaching. Now, I'd played on the Weekend Warriors, and that team that we had was all the coaches in the league. It was all the people that were invested in the league. And one of them in particular was my buddy Donnie. Now, Donnie was our pitcher on Weekend Warriors on a slow pitch softball team, and every game that we had, our team was so good that in the first game we would win, but by the second game we had broke open the cases of beer and we could barely finish. It was that kind of a league. But Donnie coached his son, DJ, who was 2 years older than the kids I was coaching, which meant that the way that baseball works, you have certain age cutoffs. You have 8U, 10U, 12U, 14U, 16U. Works the same way in soccer and all kinds of other sports. So the 8U kids I had, the oldest kids, when they would get too old, would move up and they would play with his son the next year. So we were always kind of sharing a group of friends, a group of kids, and we were all connected. Now, to picture Donnie, imagine this. How many of you know who Arnold Schwarzenegger is? I hope most hands go up. Arnold could have been Donnie's body double. 6'4", 310 pounds, looked exactly like Schwarzenegger if Schwarzenegger was 6'4", 310 pounds. He was huge, but he was the nicest guy in the world. Everybody loved him, including me. I loved that guy. And my first memory of him, outside of him playing on our softball team, was going to a baseball field and seeing him sitting on a bucket throwing soft toss to his kids, one after another. It's okay, you can do it. It's okay, you can do it. It's okay, you can do it. That bucket collapsed after 2 years. He was a great guy. I loved him. So by May 10th, 2016, we had had to move. And when we moved, the entire community threw a going away party for us because I had coached all the sons, my wife had coached all the daughters. We were part of the community. They were going to miss us, and I was going to miss them. Well, my wife's career is what took us away, so I didn't have that. I worked for myself. I didn't have a connection in South Florida. She did. I did not. So every day I would get up and I would walk the dog and I would get the most inappropriate text messages from my buddies who were still in Orlando. They were memes. They were videos. They were not suitable for work. They were not suitable around most human beings, but they were hysterical. And I loved them. We kept in touch from memes and from texts. So by the time that I was coming back that morning, May 10th, 2016. Now, how many of you have ever seen Florida, South Florida, in May? In Indiana, we call that late winter. In Florida, they call that early summer. It was 92 degrees, 90% humidity at 9:30 in the morning. I just walked a mile and a half, 2 miles with my dog. I had sweat pouring down my face. I had that big stain that goes down your shirt. The white on the bottom that I had been wiping my face off. My dog was panting. We were miserable trying to get back home. And I wore glasses, so the more I sweated, the more that I would get those little drips on the inside of your glasses. All of you wearing glasses are like, oh yeah, I know that, and it sucks. And I get to the gate, and I put my card in the gate, and just as I start to open it, my phone buzzes. And it's a text message from my buddy in Orlando. And I expect it to be something that I should not ever view around a priest. But instead, it says this. Donnie is dead. He took his life. I remember falling to the ground and just wailing. That drip on the inside of my glasses stopped being perspiration and sweat and just turned into this cavalcade of tears. I could not believe, the strongest person I knew in the world had decided that it was the end of his time and he had committed suicide. And it wasn't just that he had done it, because as I started making calls, because again, text messages, worst way to get bad news, they have your number, so I called back instead of texting back. He had gone to the same field where we had coached for all of those years, for 10 years, went to the visitor's dugout, texted his son at school, said, "You're going to be better off this way," pulled out a gun, and ate it. And I found out from a text message. 4 days later, that Saturday, I found myself sitting in a funeral home in Orlando, Florida, surrounded by all of my family who had all come together, trying to make sense of what just had happened to Donnie. And we kind of started piecing things together and talking about it and realized that while we had been sharing information, none of it was information we should have been sharing. Donnie had lost his job twice. He was let go when his hotel was bought out. He was a security manager and he became redundant. He got a new job and his new boss didn't like that he had been around for so long and everyone knew him and said that it was time for him to go a second time. Was fired twice within a year. His wife had left him. He had walked in on his wife cheating on him with another one of our friends. He didn't have a wife anymore. He didn't have a career anymore. He had started drinking more heavily. He had stopped socializing with all of us who he knew because we weren't connected as much. He had a new girlfriend, and it was the mom of one of the kids that I had coached. It was one of the younger kids, and they had moved in together, and things were starting to look up, and we all said, "Oh, it's going to be okay. He's going to be fine." And then one day, he saw her phone buzz and realized she was on Tinder. His wife had left him for one of our friends, and now his girlfriend was on Tinder. But yet none of us put the pieces together. And I remember sitting there in that chair, in that funeral home, and I started to get engulfed with this cloud of uncertainty, this cloud of despair. It was like being wrapped in being swaddled in an envelope of darkness. And I felt like I was melting into the floor, following down my black pants and black shoes and just melting into the carpet and trying to go away. And it wasn't because I was so sad of Donnie. It was because of everybody that was friends with him, I should have known. I should have known, because on October 27th, 2013, I tried to take my life. And it was the second time that I had failed. And I had followed that same sort of thing that Donnie had followed. I had lost my job, and all of a sudden, I didn't have an identity anymore. You know, when you meet somebody and say, "Hi, I'm Scott, what do you do?" What do you say when you don't do? You just don't have anything anymore. And you've identified yourself by your job, and now there's no job, and you lose yourself. My wife was traveling, and I was home alone. It was just me and the dogs and nothing, absolutely nothing. And I remember the day before, my rock bottom day. I was sitting in my friend's Miata. Yes, I fit into a Miata. Barely. My head was rubbing across the top. The seatbelt couldn't fasten, but I couldn't go anywhere because my knees were pressed into my chest. And I remember driving down the 417 with him, and he was in the left lane, and I was in the passenger seat, so on the right lane, all I could see were the white lines passing by me. Zip, 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 zip. And every white line that passed by me felt like quicksand. All I wanted to do that day was to figure out how to open the door and fall out of the car at 75 miles an hour, because I didn't want to go any farther. But it was a Miata. I wasn't going anywhere. But the next day, I was home alone. And remember when we were kids, quicksand was everywhere. It was in the comics. It was in the movies. I thought quicksand was going to be a really big problem when I became an adult. What I didn't know was that quicksand was just a metaphor for what happens with depression, what happens with mental illness. That the more you struggle to get out, the deeper you fall, and it sucks you in and doesn't let you up, and you can't breathe, you can't see, you can't feel. All of a sudden, it's just wrapped around you, and you feel like you're drowning. And I felt like I was drowning. So my wife was away, but we had two dogs, and I love my dogs to no end. And I didn't want anything to happen to them. She was going to be home in 2 days. So I filled every bowl I could find in our house with water and food and set them out. I opened the back door so they could go out and pee and poop in the backyard. At least I wouldn't have to pick it up. And I went upstairs. And my wife had known that I was going through some stuff, and she had sent me to go see a psychologist who gave me some nice sleeping pills. So I took them, all of them, and I chased it with the one clear liquid I could find in the house that I knew would have some effect. Grain alcohol, not vodka, grain alcohol. I thought when I laid down on my bed that night, the pain would be gone. 27 hours later, I woke up. I have never had such a hangover in my life. I had vomited. All of the remnants of the vomit were on the side of my bed, but because I had two dogs, there was nothing really there anymore, because if you have dogs, you know what that really means, right? They were like, oh, treats. And I realized when I woke up, the first two thoughts I had were, I need to clean the house, and son of a bitch, I can't even fucking do this right. It felt like somebody had put socks on all of my teeth and I couldn't swallow, so I just laid there. And eventually I realized that there was this pain that radiated down my stomach, and I looked, I picked up my shirt and looked, and I was black and blue all up and down my stomach in the little marks of dog paws. I had two 70-pound dogs, and they had been jumping up and down on me from the moment that I passed out. My dogs gave me the Heimlich maneuver. They made me puke. So 27 hours later, when I woke up, I was able to wake up, and the first smell that I smelled was dog breath. And I didn't know if I was happy or sad, but I knew that I was there. So I knew what Donnie was going through. But yet, in all of those moments that I had, that I would talk back and forth in text messages, there was one thing I never asked. How are you? Are you okay? Instead, I made fun of him for being a Giants fan and a Mets fan. I made fun of him because his son was his son, and he was him. The same thing guys do. I never asked how he was. So as I'm sitting there and I'm melting into the floor, recalling all of this, going through my head, and I'm revisiting all of this, my buddy sitting beside me, who we had coached together for years, he nudged me and he goes, dude, you okay? You're pale. And I kind of snapped out of it, and at that same moment, my phone buzzed. And it was a text message from my wife. How are you? I love you. Be well. That's a text message we should all get. I sat there and I listened to all of the stories that everyone told about their relationships with Donnie. And as I did, I had a different perspective from everybody else in that room. And one thing became very clear. We all loved him, but nobody told him that we loved him. We just assumed he knew because we were in his life. But nobody said, Donnie, I love you. How can I help? Nobody did that. I remember his son getting up on stage and thanking everybody that came there, and I just had too much, and I got up and I walked towards the door, and as I opened the door to go outside, I realized there were close to 300 people in the parking lot, 200 people in the funeral home, almost 500 people there to pay their respects to him, and Donnie couldn't have reached out and said, dude, I'm hurting, help me. 500 people loved him, and nobody said, how can we help you? And he never asked for help himself. Obviously, I've moved again since Donnie passed away. And we still text back and forth, but we do something else. We call. I actually had somebody visit me from Orlando, Florida, in Fort Wayne, Indiana. In the winter. That says something, right? I miss Donnie every day. But I also know that in the back of my mind, I did something that's unforgivable to so many people. And that I would have been that person that had been laying there and people would have been talking about me instead of to me. And I never thought that would be me. When I was a kid growing up and all the way through my life, I thought that the face of depression would be, I don't know, like Robert Smith or Morrissey or Edward Scissorhands or Michael Stipe. But one day I realized I looked in the mirror and the face of depression was the face looking back at me. And it's something that I have to live with every single day. But we don't, as guys, we're conditioned to not tell people this. We're conditioned to keep that inside and push it down and to never let that out anywhere because it's not cool, it's not manly, it's not what we're supposed to do in society. But yet so many of us hurt in so many ways. Now, I don't tell this story because I want anybody out there to feel sorry for me, have sympathy for me. I tell this story because I've told it before, and every time I've told it, somebody in the audience has come up to me afterward and said, I looked in the mirror this morning and I thought I was the face of depression and I don't know how I got here. It's a silent disease that eats all of us and makes us fall into this quicksand and melt into our shoes and leave us and leave those relationships. I can't imagine the pain that Donnie's life has right now. I can't imagine the pain of those people that loved him, that were related to him. I can't imagine the pain of his son, who gave up an incredibly promising baseball career. I made fun of that kid, but he threw 97 miles an hour at 16 years old. He was a stud, and he quit because his dad wasn't there to coach him anymore, and it reminded him too much of baseball. He quit. And I think of all of us and what we could have done and what we didn't do. And this is National Suicide Prevention Month, and I just ask all of you, who do you know that's being reserved? Who do you know that has a story that you've tried to explain away that shouldn't be explained away? And are you that person that has 500 people ready to show up at your funeral, at your viewing, that instead you should just reach out and say, I hurt? Because we all hurt at different times. Now, this is a surprising story for some people that are here, because if you're a Toastmaster, you know me as the energetic, the lively one, the one with the energy, the one that gets people going. I'm the fun one in the group. But yet, in my mind, I might be fun on the outside, but in my mind, I know the stuff that makes me where I am today, and it's hidden behind a facade. If you have a facade, reach out to somebody who you love, because they're going to want to help you. Don't let anybody go through what Donnie's family went through. Now, you would think the story should have a great ending because, well, I'm still here. I had never told my wife this story because I just cleaned up the puke and washed the carpet and took the dogs out and cleaned it all up, and she never knew until 4 days ago when we were walking and I said, hey, by the way, when I'm going to Trapdoor, I'm telling this story. You should probably know about it first. When I said that during the workshopping, I thought two people were going to pass out. Don't let yourself be in that situation. You're amongst friends. We love you all, man.